Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and we're here with Super 8. Yes, we're rolling out the 8mm with Matt Walden and Jason Wingrove. Matt, how are you?
Excellent. Great to be here. Great to be here for this film, too.
Yeah, it's a good film. It's a really interesting film in the sense that, well, certainly it taps into my youth and understanding of what it was to have a big blockbuster film come summer release time. What about you, Jace? Did you enjoy the film?
What you said.
Yeah. So I guess all of us grew up on kind of Spielbergian films. And certainly for me, this was just a classic case of I felt like the story was original. I also thought that I was looking at some interesting hybrid of Poltergeist, E.T., and Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Did this feel to you, Matt, like a Spielberg film, even though it was, of course, a very glary and lens-flary J.J. Abrams film?
Yeah, it really did. I mean, it really reminded me so much of all the films that I grew up watching as a kid, going with my buddies to the Cinedome in Orange, California, in Southern California. We'd go there on a, you know, Saturday midday, and we would sneak from one movie to the next, and, you know, we would spend all, at least once a week all summer long, that's what we would do, and we would just watch movies like this, and it was so reminiscent of it. I mean, I had a couple of thoughts watching it. One, I mean, I just totally loved it. I love the movie overall. I thought it was just great. It was it's perfect homage to really all the films of that era, which I think was really specified as its direct intent.
Yeah.
But the other thing too was I couldn't help but walk out of there and feel like, God, you know, all those really sort of magical, special memories I thought were, you know, sort of just mine from my childhood. I was like, God, everybody had those, you know, like when it's all said and done, like, you know, that was J.J. Abrams' childhood too. Like, which is probably why, you know, a film like this in the end maybe resonates so much. I wonder, and my students are all, you know, it's summer here, so everyone's out of school. So I'd be really curious to hear from some of my students who are all in their very early, some to mid-20s, I guess, and to hear their take on this film and whether or not it resonates for them in the same way, because I don't think they grew up with this kind of film. And I'd be really curious to hear from a younger person's perspective whether or not it works in the same way that I think it probably works for the three of us.
Yeah. Well, Jace, you, with your directorial hat on, maybe can sort of point us in terms of plot and stuff. I mean, how did you think it went in terms of just a film before you get into the visual effects?
Well, yeah, I agree. It was definitely one of those sort of love letter to all the films of that era, and Dante and Spielberg, and it's definitely an era I grew up in, watching every shot over and over again. I maybe felt that it just took a little while to get going. I mean, obviously what it's doing wonderfully is immersing yourself in that whole sort of suburban kind of life and the characters and all their interactions, of course, so that you obviously, you know, get invested in all the characters and thus get concerned with what happens to them. But I did feel it take a little bit of a while to get going, but that was, you know, I really felt it was a really lovely, really lovely film. It once it did get going, it was fantastic. I loved the ending. I loved it. I really, really can't fault it, apart from maybe just the fact that I guess it just took a little while. But along that whole journey is still lovely. You know, you're not saying, come on, get on with it. It's just, you know, I guess you know something is going to happen. It just took a while to get there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the thing that this film has that we should probably touch on is the two things, which is the merging of the J.J. Abrams famous TED talk of the mystery box, probably more literally on screen in this film than any other J.J. film we've seen. And then the second thing is a sort of a Spielberg Jaws don't show the monster right up front, because if we don't see the monster, our imagination makes it more terrifying. Now, we've often reference the latter of those two as being a really good thing to do, to just sort of not have everything up in your face. And of course, this whole idea of, you know, having some mystery of not revealing everything was carried through right to the marketing of the film. Now, some people criticize the marketing of the film as a consequence, maybe not delivering the same box office opening because it was an older style film marketing approach of not revealing what the film was really about and being very very much of the sort of school of, if you come and see it, it'll make sense, but we're not going to tell you what happens. And there's another film out at the moment. I haven't seen it yet, obviously, Rise of the Apes. But it felt like, when I was watching Rise of the Apes trailer, that I just saw the whole film. I was like, okay, so they get given a drug and they're going to become thing, and then he's going to release the other apes, and then all the other apes are going to rampage. And I'm like, now, I could be proven wrong, right? I could go to the cinema and see an entirely that all happens in the first opening act. But certainly in the case of Super 8, the trailer was all about the opening scene of the sort of train crash and didn't give me anything much after that.
Yeah, I think maybe that's why I kind of felt, come on, this is taking a while to get going, because I'd heard a little bit too much. I'd been a victim of spoilers, and I really sort of, you know, just heard one too many details. So you kind of was, you know, I knew what was to come. So if you weren't, you know, if you just followed the normal PR and looked at the trailer, sort of stuff, you would not know what was going on. And it was, you know, I guess that I sort of, for this weird thing of the fact that my impression of the film was kind of ruined by a little bit, hearing a bit too much. So I'm fully with them with their PR on this. I thought it was fantastic. I think it's one of those things where the film speaks for itself, and now it is getting that slow burn. It is getting a lot of traction now because of just word of mouth, and people are out there telling people that you really must go see it. So, you know, I think they've done the right thing.
Hey, so let's discuss it in terms of the visual effects. Now, this is an ILM film. Interestingly, Dennis Muren was on the film. He wasn't on it as the primary visual effects supervisor. I got a chance to actually sit down, talk to him, to Paul, a couple of other people at ILM when I was over there a couple of weeks ago. And the reason I say it was interesting about Dennis Muren, apart from the fact that obviously he's a living legend, is he was on the original Spielberg films that this film kind of referenced. And he made some really interesting points, and I'll see if you guys sort of felt this. He said that the trick was this idea of being able to have visual effect shots that made you feel, as opposed to visual effect shots that made you kind of get wowed. And secondly, that there was more time in this film for those effect shots to play out so that you could have an emotional response to them, as opposed to some films where it's like, he described this as action sequence, bit of drama or dialogue, action sequence. And I certainly feel the Bond films went that way for a long time. It was just like, we're going to go now into a set piece, an action piece. And when that action piece is over, we'll get back to the plot. Mm. And I don't really expect much out of this action sequence other than it's going to be a bit of a thrill ride. And I need one of those every 15 minutes in the film. And normally that's why it's a chase sequence. And really the fact that they had a chase to get from A to B, they could have easily almost cut that in two shots. So, same with you, Jace. Do you feel that those comments from Dennis Muren are really kind of how you interpreted the visual effects?
Yeah, well, I do agree. I mean, obviously, I think what's interesting is that we, as an audience, got to see about as much of the monster as those involved in the film. You know, we were along for the similar sort of ride. We got to see about as much as they did. So it was as much of a kind of a mystery to us throughout. So I mean, obviously, the whole how much you reveal of the monster thing is obviously went back to the time of Jaws, where they had no choice. The footage they were getting was awful, and they had no choice but to trim the footage back, and that's actually worked in its favor. But here, obviously, you've got complete choice all the way through in lighting and how much out of the shadows you reveal and tease the monster out. And I was really great. I thought, you know, it worked really well because, again, we were on the same ride as those, you know, as the characters in the film. So, yeah, it was well done.
I don't know if you noticed this, Matt, but did you see the trailer for this film?
I did, yeah.
Okay, so if you watch the trailer, the carves of the train smash, obviously, in the same narrative plot as happens in the film. The trailer is told from a completely different point of view on the ground. The trailer is not told from the point
definitely.
Of view of the kids.
Even the teaser trailer is told, I think, from a different point of view than the first sort of longer form theatrical trailer. I think even the teaser was something that looked like it wasn't even something that was shot. It was just a really early teaser where they show a tiny bit of the train crash and then the train car, the U.S. Air Force train car with the sort of pounding beast on the metal door, and you never see anything in the first teaser. And then in the subsequent trailer, it's from a totally different point of view. Like the train crash, it's sort of coming at you, where you're, I think, following the car or following the truck that drives onto the train track. You're behind it, and the train crashes into the truck, and the train cars sort of come towards camera. And in the film, it's totally different. We're on the platform with sort of the protagonists, or the main characters, the kids that make up the primary cast in the film, and we see it from a totally different point of view.
So as I said, I was talking to Paul Kavanagh, who was the animation supervisor on this, and that's all very deliberate. And I'm picking up on Jason's point about, you know, you saw the monster as much as the kids saw it. So in the film, they wanted the train wreck to happen and for it to be seen from the kids' point of view, that you saw the train wreck only as the kids would see it. Now, occasionally there was a point of view shot like running beside the kids, but you were down with the kids. If the kids understood it, it's because the kids could see it. We understood it because we could sort of also see it. In the trailer, especially that teaser trailer, which was done incredibly early on, a conscious decision was made to not do it that way. So the audience was witnessing this thing, but only when you sort of got into the film did you see it from the kids' point of view. And I thought that was great, because I've always kind of assumed that the trailer stuff is a bit more random, a bit less thought out, and certainly a lot less considered in terms of its relationship to the film. And if you did shots that were only for the trailer, it was because you couldn't work out to do it properly or it was a mistake. This absolutely wasn't the case. And I think that sort of lends itself to a really interesting level of credibility to how they approach so much of the film. I'm going to ask you also, do we like the amount of lens flares and sort of, because I mean, we obviously got used to them a bit on Star Trek, but there were a lot of kind of very, very anamorphic blue things in frame that in any other world back maybe even the 70s would have been considered as false.
I mean, I think, you know, that I just think that seems like J.J. Abrams' signature thing. Like in, somewhere online, there's a picture. If you look up J.J. Abrams' Star Trek lens flares, there's a hilarious spoof photograph of like the characters, the main characters from his Star Trek film, just standing in a very undynamic scene on like the bridge or something. And off of every possible element, there's a huge lens flare, right? That's kind of the joke, cliche conceit of J.J. Abrams. I mean, I think stylistically, clearly that's something that he's really enamored with, and he can't not do that. It's even in the poster art for the film, the one with where the sideways point of view, there's the same kind of lens flare. I just feel like that's part of his, at least for the moment, aesthetic. You know, personally, I could do with maybe a little bit less of that, but at the same time, because I feel like it's going to date itself. It's going to be like Bleach Bypass or something, you know, like over time, we're going to look back on that. And I suspect we're going to see that as something that's a bit over the top, maybe, but I don't know. I'd be curious. What did you think of it, Jason? Would you concur? Do you think it's too much?
Not entirely. I mean, in Star Trek, it's definitely used for dramatic effect. It's a very much stronger, more striking, more modern visual film, and I think it's, you know, often used for definitely, you know, in heightening, like, you know, dramatic effect on the bridge and stuff. This lens flares are much less, there's much less lens flares in Super 8. A lot of them are more motivated by, there's a couple of times where they're, in Star Trek, all of those flares are almost off screen. They had guys just standing there with LED torches right off frame, like putting them in where there's no motivation in the frame. In Super 8, there's generally, you know, they've got sort of floodlights on cars and trains and stuff off the off houses, and so it's all mostly motivated from within the frame. And you know, these guys have used old Panavision C series and E series lenses, so they literally probably used the very same actual lens that probably was on, you know, was on many of the Spielberg films of that era. So it's actually not entirely faked up. It's actually, you know, a bit more of a homage than a dramatic technique.
That was actually something I was wondering, like, are they all actual in-camera lens flares, or and they're shooting,
hard to tell,
know,
isn't
at
it,
such a,
these days?
In an angle to get that, or are they actually adding any of those after the fact? I wondered.
It's hard to tell these days because the post-production flares are getting so good and so amazing, and you can add dust to the lens and occlusion, and you can add a lot of artifacts to make it look very, very real. They did look a little bit cleaner and more modern than the flares I'm used to. I'm a bit of a flare fan. but look, they certainly use the right glass, and as I say, they're all more motivated to within the frame, and certainly a lot less than Star Trek. So, you know, if you look through a lot of like Close Encounters, there's a ton of flair in there, and it's definitely, you know, have been throughout Spielberg's films many an opportunity that they could have removed them where they left them in there. So,
well,
no, I think
close,
it's more
Close Encounters
than,
too, though. You're also getting a lot of flares in the visual effects because it's
true.
A real sort of Douglas Trumbull kind of signature thing.
Trumbull,
he winds up doing the same thing later on
in
Blade Runner as well, and in Brainstorm. There's some of that as well in the film that he directed. You know, so I think it's interesting. Citing those early films too.
Yeah, so more homage than overused wanky effect, and bring it on. I was expecting more. People had complained about them in Twitter and stuff before I'd seen the film, and I thought, oh no, this is going
to
be
bad. I think it's an easy thing to latch onto. I actually think in the Trek film, I liked them a lot because it gave this idea that space was glary, and that, you know, if you actually look at the NASA footage, like obviously in a non-atmosphere environment, it is really glary and incredibly harsh lighting.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought it was valid in that respect. In this film, I thought it was used for a different reason. I'm a little concerned that it's a cheap shot to make it and that he'll take them out as a consequence, but I think it looked good. It certainly gave the film part of that period feel, and it, you know, was a period film in the sense that, you know, there was... It wasn't set today. These kids were shooting with Super 8 in a period when, you know, that lensing was appropriate. So that did add to it. I mean, I think it's dangerous when you're making a period thing that's only, you know, 20, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. It can look kind of silly. I mean, I think the period nature of this film was far more successful and less comical than the period nature of X-Men, which we discussed a few weeks ago, where it felt to me much more shagadelic and kind of go-go-y, and I was like, yeah, really. You know, whereas like the periodness of Mad Men doesn't seem sort of kitsch and goofy. It seems really authentic.
And a lot of times when people put those flares in post, it's because they've actually been too cheap to actually shoot anamorphic properly in the first place, and they've just added them in as a bit of an effect. This is, you know, from ground up, they've used the right glass and the right format, and so, you know, it's I believe it's reasonably honestly motivated.
I can tell you that if you were trying to do the effects under the glares, they'd create a lot of problems.
I'm sure.
Not that ILM can't fix them, but they're
sure
really
used to it.
It's not the easiest thing in the world to tackle. Okay, so let's discuss the sequences. So let's start with the train wreck. It's the big action piece. It needs to be awe-inspiring because it's, you know, if we're down with the kids and it's kids' point of view, anything like that would be. It was also fairly over the top. Did we feel that we'd... Did we, you know... I mean, I actually went back and looked at the greatest show on Earth, which I think was one of the train wrecks referenced by the filmmakers. Now, this was a miniature train wreck. It's a circus train wreck. And, you know, it was a period way, way before we had the tools we had today. I have to say, though, it was completely lame. I mean, this was just completely awesome. So somebody I heard sort of said, oh, I really wish they'd gone and done it with miniatures and stuff. But I don't. I think that, you know, there was no reason to make something deliberately inferior just for the purposes of being retro. I think you wanted to make it as good as you could and just have it authentic. So I thought the train wreck was really, really good. Now, there were a couple of things that were the sort of CG perfect framing, like, you know, a large slab of the door landing right on... cue camera right in the ground. But then again, you know what? I mean, is that not just completely acceptable inside movie magic? I mean, that stuff happens, right? I don't know.
Well, Matt, I kind of thought, too, like, you know, watching the train crash, like, that was sort of the first big effects moment in the film. And it was the one that was, again, also referenced in the teaser as well as in the trailer. So you know that that's kind of the beginning of the action in the story. That's sort of like the... you know, the inciting incident or whatever, right, in Act One. Like, that becomes the really key moment where it sets off all the events that take place through the rest of the narrative. And I thought it was sort of like the train crash in The Fugitive, you know, the Harrison Ford version of The Fugitive on steroids, right? And there was a moment in the film or in the crash sequence where, like, I kind of laughed out loud thinking, like, come on, this is absurd. Like, it's so ridiculous. Like, the amount of... sort of gas, diesel explosions, like huge things going on. But at the same time, I think that one of the reasons why I sort of forgive it, and I feel like in a way it kind of works, is because it really does create a kind of edge of your seat moment. It was really it felt like, again, a little bit more still of an homage to those earlier films. And I think in some thematic way too, like it kind of sits in nicely, even in its over the top way, with the very essence of the story of what these kids are doing. Like, you have these kids making a film within a film, which again, as a sort of, you know, plot device, becomes really handy and useful in that I think you can, in an instance like the train crash, I think you can exaggerate some of those things and take them a little bit further into the world of, you know, just absolute fantasy in terms of the extremity of it and the degree to which it kind of went on and get away with that too, because, you know, you're kind of already, they're playing in this world of make-believe too, you know, and so you kind of go there with it. It doesn't need to feel like, you know, a documentary version of a train crash. So I thought it worked great, and I thought the way that it was executed, I mean, it helps that it was at night, for sure, and even in its over-the-top way, I mean, it's ILM doing what it does best. You know, I think Kim Librari, who I worked with at ESC Entertainment back on the Matrix sequels, was, I believe, the on-set supervisor for the bulk of the train crash, if I'm not mistaken, from Todd's notes. And, I mean, everything just came together great. It just looked phenomenal. I don't think there was a shot in that on a technical level that I called into question, you know, for myself. Nothing took me out of it other than, you know, maybe the length of the pile up that occurred.
It was certainly larger than life.
I mean, there was a couple of moments.
Crashes through the
There was a couple of moments.
Station house. I thought that was the one where you really were like, "Whoa!"
No, yay. The one for me was the jettisoning of the large sort of cylinder type freight car thing up
like into the air.
Yeah, and that to me was, it was a very much like there were two guys walking past with a piece of glass as there was a car pile up, or there just happened to be a ramp that a car would go over on one wheel and flip. It was the convenient, you know, wasn't it convenient? We just happened to have one of these things that would shoot up like that. Now, that being said, I kind of enjoyed it. I mean, it didn't sure. bug me. It was like kind of fun to watch. And
maybe it's like those kind of car crash, you know, when you have a car crash and you have that major incident, it's always, you always remember it much larger life than it actually was. And what, you know, maybe again, harking back to the fact that it's all seen maybe from the kids' point of view, that this is how they remember it. And
that is exactly mm-hmm. what they were trying to do. It would be, if
the
you remember
design,
a train.
Oh my God, the sound design.
If you remember a train crash, this is how so you remember helped. It.
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely larger than life.
I think that's a great example.
The physics and the momentum of the train was maybe way more larger than life, but it didn't take me out of the film. It just added to the entire impact and the drama of it, as did the sound design, which was utterly stunning through the entire film. I saw it was projected digitally, and the sound was just built cinema, and it was just,
was it a 7.1 mix? Because I know,
I actually don't know. I wish they should for us techno, us geeks at the door, should have that. Today's screening is screened in 2K or 4K. This is your projector will be a Christie whatever.
Yeah.
And it's in 7.1 through.
And this is how many lumens we've got the projector set at today. Yeah.
It would be great, you know, because there's no point asking any of the pimply teens that run the place.
I mean, it was Dolby, but I just don't know if it was 7.1 or 5.1. But I've got to say, I totally agree with you. But here's something interesting just about the physics. One of the things that was really interesting in talking to the guys is they were saying they had a lot of trouble with the trains moving left to right, say, and it hits the car. Now, it's moving left to right, but the shockwave is traveling back right to left. So you actually have a kind of concussion wave going back up the train mm-hmm. that's causing a lot of the damage, but the train is all moving the other way, which makes it kind of a confusing thing to get the dynamics on. I actually thought they did a good job in keeping it sensibly, you know, because otherwise you go into this world that I hate, which is it's just destruction. I don't know what's going on anymore.
Yeah.
When the dust clears, I'll try and work it out, just get over and done with it.
Yes, it was very staged, wasn't it? And you really had an impressive view of the fact of sort of domino principle of what this causes this, which causes this, which causes that. And it was really that wonderful sort of Spielbergian kind of boarded out thing that it really wasn't. Let's just, if we'd shot a miniature, we would have just probably had maybe a couple of takes and we would have had control over some of the aspects of it, but we would have essentially been left up to the way it piles up versus have a bit more control story-wise of the way that accident played out. And I guess maybe that's a complete argument for doing it the way they did versus doing this like Moon, where we go back to the sort of 70s retro, let's do it all miniatures, because that's a homage to that style. So
I was wondering, Mike, when you talked to the guys at ILM, do you know, did they have a VFX art director board out the sequence, or did they do a previs of that whole sequence?
It was previs. It was previs, because what happened is they had the entire post-rec train set up pretty much for real, right? Cranes got in and laid stuff out. Yeah, and then there was no train. Everything else was added in digitally. So they sort of rebuilt backwards. So they started digital. Everything exploded digital and then ended up with what was left there as sort of live action elements.
Right.
The only thing I'd say is that, and I mean this with honestly hand on heart, everything, as impressive as that explosion of the train was, I was probably still slightly in shock from Elle's performance.
I completely agree.
Because her, you know, rehearsal of just the rehearsal.
Let's just rehearse it. Hold it back a bit.
Yeah. And I've got to say, I thought she was sensational. I mean, just
absolutely. You know, I got to jump in and say here that the one thing when we first started talking about this film at the very beginning of the show, the one thing that I think is really key to think about when you watch this film, which gets back to the sort of the famous TED talk about the mystery box and stuff too, is that, you know, you look at this and what is this film really about? Well, it's really, at the core of it, it's a totally character-driven film. It's putting, you know, essentially unknown child stars in primary roles in the film where they're having to really carry the weight of this thing. And it gets back to that, I think it was in that, you guys, I have only seen it once, but so correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think it's in that TED talk where he is talking about the mystery box and the whole concept of it not opening that thing from the magic shop or whatever, and that the promise of what's inside, the potential, is almost more interesting. But is it in that same talk where he says, you know, I wanted to show you this clip from Close Encounters, and he shows the clip of Roy Scheider and the little boy at the table? Where they're in Jaws, where they're sitting at the table and Roy Scheider's got his hands in his face kind of because he's so distressed over the, you know, the closing of the beach and his new position as the sheriff of the little town or whatever.
Mm.
And his son starts kind of mimicking him and they sort of have this play back and forth. Is that in that same talk?
Yep, I think so.
Remember?
Yep, I think so.
Because I think that, you know, and he says that that's kind of his favorite moment from that film, and it's sort of the opposite of what, you know, you'd expect, and I think he makes an allusion to that. And I think this whole movie, and Mike, you make that very point, you know, by saying that you think her performance, where she really captures that moment, and they're all captivated by her, you know, they're all kind of have a crush on her or whatever, and they're sort of captivated by her, her you know, young youthful beauty or whatever, and then by her performance, and that really is the thing that sticks with you, because that's really what it's about, you know. And I think that's the neatest thing about this film, and it gets into what I think is kind of the essence of this movie at the core, which is, you know, here's a guy at the peak of his sort of Hollywood superstar career, right? J.J. Abrams is like the guy, right? Like, he could probably do no wrong. He could pick his project. I mean, he's like Hollywood's golden boy. And he takes the opportunity that he has as an auteur, as a filmmaker, and he says, I'm going to go out and I'm going to make a film that is the kind of film that I grew up watching in Super 8. And it's the kind of film, really, that Hollywood doesn't make anymore. You know, he uses all his clout to go out and make something that is outside of the realm of what we see these days, for the most part, and, you know, really kind of gambles that this is what movies are about. This is what audiences want to see. They don't want to necessarily see, you know, Iron Man 3 or X-Men 7 or whatever. Like, maybe they really do want to see a movie that's a story about people, you know, and maybe supernatural and fun and exciting and mysterious things can happen within that world. But
Yeah, Hollywood still keeps getting told these lessons, though. You know, well, I say Hollywood, I mean just in general. Filmmakers still keep being shown that this is the way, but they still don't, you know, sometimes often don't.
I just think it's really, really commendable and very cool that J.J. Abrams would use his clout at this time to do something like this.
I got to say, as good as her performance was on the train, the other one that killed me, just well before we get back to the effects, is her as the zombie doing the thing, which I just thought was genius. But I tell you the other thing I thought about it that was nice is here's somebody that didn't talk down to the audience or didn't think that they were cleverer than the audience. Like, it would have been really easy to have a scene where he was humiliated by her or embarrassed by the other guys, and it would have been an easy laugh. And, you know, we didn't want him to be humiliated. We didn't want him to just be completely embarrassed and hurt her. It would have been so formulaic to just do that, right? You know, she gets... They, you know, somehow tease her. He looks like an idiot in front of her, and then she comes back at the end. Mm. They didn't do that. Like, it was kind of respectful, even though the guys were young.
Can I quickly jump back to her performance on the train station? I know it's not a film review, but part of the power of her little performance there is the reactions of the other guys to it, and those two intercut make a really powerful scene. Just a little note that, you know, it's, her performance is great, but you see it again through their eyes, and you see their reactions to it, and that makes it, you know, probably twice as powerful.
Yeah, I mean, I did think that there was also a ton of, we haven't mentioned this, but there's a ton of in-jokes in there that were really aimed at filmmakers. I mean, and obviously the one that I guess most people latched onto is the production value remark, but, you know, it really was a film for people that liked films, wasn't it? I mean, it was, as much as it was a love note to, you know, I don't know, Spielberg films, it was a love note to other filmmakers. I mean, you know, and people like Dennis Muren grew up actually, you know, making Super 8 films. In fact, actually, Yankee made before Super 8.
Sure.
He made an 8mm film, I think I'm right in saying.
Standard 8.
And he had, it was like a, yeah, standard 8, like a $10 Keystone camera. And, you know, he did original makeup zombie stuff with Rick Baker as like a kid. Because I found all of that. Elmer and Charlie Muren, his parents, gave him his camera when he was like 10. And he went on to make a film called Equinox, which was a short film, like, which got picked up and got actually added to and then released as a full-on feature. This is the way at the start of his career. So that whole idea of, like, picking up a camera, I mean, for the filmmakers themselves was an incredible kind of step. So
and that level of nostalgia, too, I think, just from a totally effects point of view, that level of nostalgia is really important and significant in that, you know, I could cite and I'm sure we all could cite a host of friends and people that we've worked with who, you know, got into working in visual effects because of Star Wars or Close Encounters or 2001 or whatever the film might be. Mm. You know, and I actually have also, too, a whole host of friends who maybe kind of more like the kid in this movie, a good friend of mine, Keith Edmeyer, who's a sculptor now in New York and does like fine art sculpture. He worked for a long time. He worked for Rick Baker and he worked for a bunch of those guys in LA growing up. He worked on like The Fly and stuff, doing makeup effects before he got into doing fine art sculpture. And he grew up on all these same films. And for him as a kid, he was the guy who was into all the, like, the gory makeup effects. Like, that was his thing, just like this kid in this movie. And I think it's so interesting to see, you know, those trajectories, like people, you know, who wind up going into the business, they all shared, you know, we all sort of share a common sort of historical knowledge and historical experience of these different films, and they affect all of us in different ways, given your background and where you come from and whatnot. But I think it's so neat that that's an element of the story.
Look, honestly, film, I was doing Super 8. I literally shot with my friends Super 8 film, edited in camera because we couldn't edit. Then we got to the stages of being able to edit in camera, but we recorded the soundtrack in one continuous take by playing the movie and all handing the microphone around to do that. And then
that's just too cool. That's so cool.
And then, yeah, and literally it was part of the reason for doing it was just to pick up girls, right? Because we could get girls to be in our film. I mean, I just was sitting in the thing. I'm not joking. And my first film was literally the end. Like, my father had the end of the – I couldn't even afford the film, but he had an end of a take, like a what we'd call, you know, a
short end.
Short end. And so I had 45 seconds of film to make a 45-second film, right? And so we'd rehearse it, rehearse it, rehearse it, and then do the take and then cut and then have to do the next scene that came after it because we were all editing it in camera. But I then went on to actually do a proper short film in Super 8, which actually got me my first film commission grant. And then I got to move it up to 16 and finish it. Of course, it was incredibly badly edited and stuff because I hadn't really learned about editing. I'd learned how to frame a shot, just not to edit a shot. And you might say my whole career has been I'm good on one shot but not putting them together. But I was going to say the other thing is before we leave Alice or Elle, you know, she was in Benjamin Button as the young Kate.
Oh, very right.
I was thinking, where'd she come from? Because she's so good. But she was great in that as well. I just hadn't pieced together that was her.
When I gather she's along the line of the Fanning family, right? The Dakota Fanning, right. Elle Fanning. Are
bunch
they not
of underachievers
related?
Okay, so let's get from there to, and this is spoiler alert, so anything if you haven't seen the film,
Dakota,
please don't, because we're now going to shatter it. Okay, so let's discuss a couple of the other big set pieces. The bus attack. So now the bus attack is different in the sense that we've now progressed a long way through the movie. I guess that rule of acts, right, is like the first act is 25%, the middle act is 50%, and the last act is 25%. And at the start of the end, as it were, we have the bus attack. And that point, we actually get to see the monster. So let's discuss monster design and the bus attack itself. Much more a traditional digital sequence. I mean, this is a piece from a technical point of view that could have been in a Predator film or whatever. Jason, what do you think of the bus attack?
Oh, I thought it was astounding. I mean, it was very much like the car attack in, not quite as long, but the car attack with the kids inside it in Jurassic Park. Topping
totally.
It over and dragging it around. And although I guess
less curiosity though.
Yes. Well, there was definitely that's true. There was definitely a lot less of the monster revealed. We weren't aware of what we still at this point were still not aware of what was going on, what was attacking, you know what the whole plot was. You know, Jurassic Park, you knew kind of what was happening. You know, no mystery.
I think also in Jurassic at that point we still had quite a lot of empathy for the dinosaurs. And for the T-Rex in particular, we needed to keep that empathy because he was going to come through at the end to be the hero.
Yeah.
Where in this, I don't feel I ever had that much empathy for the alien.
Yeah. No, at this stage, we have not humanized it in any way, so to speak. We haven't sort of seen its face. We haven't sort of seen its we don't know its motivation. We don't know anything about the backstory about it. So,
we hadn't had that really clumsy and awkward sequence where they watch the films in the school and you hear the high school teacher's narration where he says, "I realized at that point that it wanted to be my friend or that it just wanted to go home."
You mean
that was the
exposition
only part in the movie.
That was
that was the only part in the script or in the film where I just was like, my wife audibly laughed next to me and I kind of rolled my eyes.
It was great that the audio tape was in sync with the projected film by accident.
Yeah,
that was good, wasn't
perfect.
It?
Perfect, I know.
Yeah. Dr. Exposition. But
yeah, exactly. Mr. DNA.
But we digress. Though there was a little bit of an effect sequence in that. You know, actually I've got to say that the effect sequence where we saw the alien in the Super 8 film, you know, obviously when they're playing it in the bedroom, looked so fake because it was like on Super 8. I don't know how they could have made it look more real, but it looked like the fake. I mean, if you'd shown me that film, I'd have gone, somebody's faked up a monster movie.
Going back to the bus crash, I mean, obviously what made it real, obviously there was, from what I can understand, it looks like completely 100% on-set physical effects of physically dragging a bus, dragging it, smashing it around, toppling it, buckling its wheels, dragging it sideways on the asphalt. It was really felt like a really strong, powerful. As much as I guess that's why I liken it to Jurassic, is that you know there's a lot of real cars involved and a lot of real physics. And it's still a bit of mystery. So, you know, it definitely had power and effect, and it was very sudden, and you know it came on. There was no oh my god, it's coming. It literally, you're driving the bus, bam.
Yeah, I think, though, I don't know how if you could have done this, but I think that in terms of the structuring of the scene, the alien is attacking the bus. Obviously, they're trapped. So that's, you know, they want to get out. But there was a point at which you felt like the alien really was distracted over there and they were going to get away.
Yeah.
It would have been nice to have one other thing to worry about, like that even if they could get out, there was petrol on the ground that was going to ignite and that they were going to get burned anyway. Yeah. You know, because like, you know... Well, the best one I can think of actually is Mad Max. You know, like they'll have this sort of, I'm trying to get the gun pellet on the front of the Mack truck and somebody's trying to kill me while I'm doing it. But, oh, by the way, don't forget, audience, there's something coming in the opposite direction. So even if he gets the bullet, if he doesn't get killed, he's going to get wiped out.
There's another level of danger.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in that one, it was like, assuming the kids can get that out that window, I was pretty comfortable they were going to get out all right.
But I think maybe the fact that we still did not know what the motivation, what is this creature, what is it going to do, what's it doing with people, you know, there was, I guess, that extra level of danger there that it was still a complete unknown at this point, what was going to happen to them if they got caught, I suppose. So it wasn't an actual other level of danger, but there was this still sort of hidden, there was still this unknown in there, I guess. But, I like the scene overall. It was.
But I mean, what made Jaws so great is that they were trying to be eaten by the shark and the boat was sinking.
True. Yeah, the bus could have been on fire as well as them being trapped, as well as the monster trying to work its way down the cab, killing people along
the
way.
But then we'd probably be sitting here criticizing it as being too formulaic. Okay, so the monster is obviously fully digital. In terms of monster design, I think they did a good job in actually coming up with an original design.
Mm.
I mean, it didn't feel...
didn't feel reminiscent of it. It didn't feel like it was
really.
Sort
you guys
of
didn't. Alien. You didn't feel like it. You guys didn't feel like it was like a. It looked like a. You know, like a J.J. Abrams monster. You didn't feel like it looked like the Cloverfield monster, kind of, or like a character from the Halo game franchise or something. Like it had a real.
The closest thing I've really seen to reference it is the Falling Skies, aliens. Oh, which that's, you could argue, has come out after that. But I don't know. For me, no, because what I didn't want is I didn't want the big kind of monster that has the multiple teeth that are inside the multiple teeth. Felt like insect-like, and it didn't feel like it was a biped, and it didn't feel like it was, you know... No,
it was like it walked on four legs and it had like two arms or something that it sometimes could walk and.
But even when it was on the water tower, I was still trying to analyze it and look at it to try and work it out, which is good, right? I hadn't I get it. I know how it works. Yeah, it's all good.
Yeah.
And the eyes were nice.
The hero close-up that we get of it, you know, it felt like it. They gave us the opportunity to really get a good look at it, at least its face. And, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I felt like looking at it, I thought, well, boy, this is something both that is frightening and menacing, but also with the distance and the scale, the size of the eyes from a design point of view, gave you the opportunity to sort of have some sympathy for it somehow, too.
Well, the eyes changed, though, right? Because there was almost like there was a semi-metallic looking, it wasn't metallic, but kind of covering over the eyes, like a membrane eyelid.
And they kind of got more glassy.
And then it opened up to reveal, the more sort of traditional eye, which is where you could kind of feel a bit more sympathetic for it.
Maybe they were a bit Starship Troopers. I don't know.
Ooh. There you go.
Not sure.
except that it had a face, right? And the Starship Troopers things were like,
well, and it didn't use a straw to try and suck the brains out of it.
No, it had that sort of crab-like multi-leggy
thing. That's true.
But that's probably the only thing that sort of, you know. But no, I mean, at least in the film, I wasn't taken out of the film by, you know, which is obviously all we're after here is to have menace, drama. You're not immediately taken out of the film by feeling unreal in any way. All the physics and momentum and its weight and everything about for me was completely perfect. And the light interacting, coming in and out of how it interacted with the people it was attacking and you know, throwing, dragging and attacking, all felt completely real. So, you know, obviously for me, the one thing as far as visual effects goes, it should obviously completely keep you within the film. Don't fuck it up.
Obviously, in this country,
I don't think any of the effects or anything were. I mean, the animation, the effects, the compositing. Like, I thought those were all really good with regards to the alien, and I never felt for a second taken out of the film by any of those effects.
And this was at night, sure. Right? Wasn't this?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there was what I really liked about it was the lighting on the animal that was definitely consciously just showing just enough
now,
to show a little
bit of it.
Incredibly
interesting that you pick up on that.
But not necessarily showing the face, not really humanizing it. It's just this beast at this stage.
I had this phenomenally interesting discussion with Dennis Muir on camera we've got of him, because I was asking about HDRs and, you know, on-set lighting stuff, and he basically, in a very nice way, just, you know, pointed out I was an ass, because he was like, well, it's not about getting the lighting right on set with HDRs. It's about lighting it sort of thematically with where you are in the plot, dramatically for where you are in the scene,
yeah,
and in a way that works for the audience. And so the lighting on the alien was very deliberately not a technical match to what was happening on the set.
But it didn't feel mismatched, though, at least.
No.
They got away with it. The only thing that sort of made you go, oh, it's being hidden, because it was, you really wanted to see a little bit more, but you couldn't quite. So I think there was definite...
I think Dennis used the term Garbo-type lighting on...
Gobo?
No.
Garbo, as in
yes,
Greta.
As in Greta. For the reveal of the eyes, face, close-up shot.
That right.
Was literally like Hollywood lighting
mm-hmm.
on the face. And
that's actually really cool, though, that you say that, like, and to hear that, you know, that's something that Dennis Muir brings up in your conversation with him, only because, you know, it does, you know, not to, I don't want to sound at all like I'm patronizing Dennis Muir, because, you know, who would I be to do something like that? But I mean, I think that's what makes the difference between somebody like Dennis, who, you know, Dennis Muir, who's a legend in the industry, and maybe younger VFX supervisor who maybe has less experience with traditional film and traditional sort of optical compositing and optical effects and stuff, or miniature effects, is that, you know, he's looking at it from with a much longer view, like a much longer historical view, and coming to it and making that comment, like to say that, you know, it's not just about, you know, getting the HDR or lighting on set. Like, it's about this whole other series of concerns that are really maybe more appropriate to be concerned with, even as a visual effects supervisor or as a visual effects artist, you know, to really think of it from the point of view of the story and from the point of view of the film. Like, there are certainly technical things that you have to concern yourself with, but at the same time, you know, there's an art to it too. And always being reminded of that, I think, is really important. And it's neat that he pointed that out.
Well, and also I think he's into the artistry of it, being completely comfortable with the technology of it. He's not into the art of it because he doesn't have a handle on the technology.
Mm.
Not at all.
But a point I suggested to him, which I think I'd suggest to you guys, is, especially you, Matt, one of the reasons that we tend to go down a bit of an HDR sampling route with lighting and stuff like that is that, given the size of the films, given the number of shots, given the incredibly short schedules, you have to kind of processize or produce a process that works so that you can commoditize to a certain extent approaches, because you can't rely on, you know, 8 gifted artists to really nail the lighting and all the
scenes.
Yeah,
no, that's true.
You end up having to say, well, I need a system that has less, there's less open to artistic interpretation that may or may not be successful, and I don't have time for that artistic interpretation even. What I need is a system that will work and will get me there. His concern, though, is that, you know, you end up in this starting place with the HDRs that then take you down a certain path. But I would argue, not saying that he's wrong, just simply that it may be we got there because we need to have systems that can cope with enormous numbers of shots in a relatively insanely short amount of time.
Yeah, well, I think, too, from a supervisor's point of view, as opposed to maybe a sequence lead's point of view, or a lighting lead, or even just a lighting TD's point of view, or a compositor's point of view, I think a supervisor's point of view is looking at it from that kind of macro scale, right, where you're, like, you're looking at everything from sort of the broadest possible perspective, and so that, you know, you can encompass in that statement about sort of an artistic bend,
you know, a recognition of and an understanding of the technical underpinnings that at least get you, you know, a good percentage of the way there. So, yeah, I think that makes sense.
What do we think of the end water tower sequence? And bearing in mind, by the way, that all the water towers all the way through the film were digital and set extensions.
Bearing but what that in mind, I'm utterly amazing, which I did not, you know, yeah. I did not twig on that at all until you told me after the fact.
I thought that the forming up was completely crazy, fantasy, whatever. But then, you know, the whole thing about any technology suitably advanced is indistinguishable from magic.
It's
completely reasonable that an alien technology that we'd already seen do the forming and unforming with the little cube things.
Yeah.
So we had some kind of sense of it being able to have shape transformations. Yeah. But, you know, it built into a really interesting-looking spaceship that looked really alien-esque and pretty impractical, but also pretty funky.
And there had to be, and what, I guess what it again sort of presented this sort of sense of mystery that, although I guess they, in the past, I guess the army had kind of worked out what this was all about, but you know, it sort of completely justified the fact that there is no big spaceship anywhere. It's all sort of in small cubes that mean nothing to the general public, and if they ever discover it, and you know, it only can then be reformed later. It's a clever idea that. You know, that the...
because otherwise you've got Race to Thunder Mountain where you're all trying to get back to the mothership to be able to take off.
Yeah, exactly. There is no mothership until it's deemed to be so.
Yeah.
And I thought there were some neat things that they did, like visual effects-wise and story-wise with the ship and the idea, like, that, you know, all those pieces of the ship sort of get thrown around after the train crash, and he takes with him that one sort of Rubik's Cube-looking piece, right, that white... kind of porcelain-looking thing.
It looks like one thing in his hand.
And then later when the Elle Fanning character is over at his house and they're talking and sort of bonding a little bit with each other while he's watching the films of his mother, there's that you see that same piece again before it flies out of the room, and it looks different. And I don't know about you guys, but immediately, like, it looked like a different thing. And I think that was obvious. I would imagine it was a conscious choice to say, okay, well, we will remember, we'll show what he picks up, and then when we show it again, it'll look different, like it's changed its shape somehow, you know, and see if people pick up on that. And then, you know, it sort of jets out of the room or whatever in that moment where it gets caught on the on that one big water tower. But I thought that was really cool. That was a nice touch.
No, totally. And it had transformed from the vibrating it had earlier in the when he was just the morning after when it was vibrating. It I think was when it was starting to change.
Yeah.
But
so I thought the tower was a complete build.
But I was going to say they called it a Rubik's Cube in the film.
Right.
This was set in 79. Rubik's Cubes didn't come out until the 80s.
I did wonder that one.
Yeah.
Oh, snap.
Yeah. 3 Mile Island was on the TV.
Yeah.
Yeah. No Rubik's Cubes during 3 Mile Island.
Yeah. Three Mile Island was correct, though. They would have got that.
There was
right.
a 3 Mile Island. Yeah, but if 3 Mile Island was on the news, that gives you the day.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm going to resend my earlier comment about liking this movie.
Do a wiki search on Rubik's Cube. I'm pretty sure Rubik's Cubes didn't come out to the 80s. I remember when they came out.
Who cares? But you know, I mean, I literally thought that they'd built the tower and it was, you know, utterly, completely photoreal and just, again, never took me out of the film.
And
all its interaction with the water and all that sort of stuff was completely...
Yeah, the formation of the ship, too, at the end. I loved all the... I know we've talked about this before, but, I mean, I am anything and all things effects animation, I just totally... anything particle-related, I always get excited about. And all those bits and pieces circulating and moving around and coming together and forming that ship, I mean, all that stuff was really great. You know, it was reminiscent of some of the stuff. I always think of that scene in, I can't remember if it's the second or the third Matrix, I guess it's the third Matrix movie where the, you know, big baby head, the Deus Machina comes up and all those little... bits and particle animations sort of come together to form the baby face or whatever. It kind of had all those really intricate dynamics going on, and I love that kind of stuff.
I think the word you're looking for there, Matt, is mint.
Yes.
Mint. The effects were mint.
Actually, this isn't... We talk about this as a mega blockbuster film. It wasn't really budgeted as such. This is not a mega blockbuster film by Transformers, you know, kind of standards. I mean, this is a film that's actually quite modest in comparison. I believe the budget's down at like under 50 mil.
Yeah.
Which for a A-grade director is almost, you know...
for that minimal PR push to have already made in excess of 70 plus million.
Oh, 100
million. Probably right, 100 million plus. Yeah, it's impressive.
Do you know what the shot count was in this movie? Because I remember as I was watching it in the theater, I'm sure there were many more effects than I was conscious of, you know, just sort of hidden, like the water towers I did not know, for example. But, you know, watching the film, I remember thinking like, wow, this is pretty cool. Like, we're watching, you know, a summer sort of blockbuster-esque movie that, you know, is sort of billed as an effects film to try to, I think, get as many heads and butts in the seats as possible. But, you know, it's basically a story about this group of kids and their relationships, their complicated relationships with their parents, or, you know, the death of a parent or whatever. And, you know, it's captivating and it's fun to watch these young actors do their thing. But there's actually, it didn't seem like there were that many effects in the movie. It didn't feel like it was an effects-driven movie. It was an effects-assisted movie in that respect.
Well, having done a few of these shows where I've been involved in the more retro-y kind of this era, I guess that's what has struck us every time we've done them has been that when you look back at them, there's actually not – when you look at the count, not the shot count, but just the physical minutes on screen of visual effects, there really is not – you know, there's not a lot. And that is the same with this. If you bother to look at it, it's more the bits between the effects that
I think it does bring into question kind of the essence of what, you know, the difference between a movie like this and a movie like Transformers 3, which granted probably none of us have seen yet, but you know, what is the, I mean, I'm excited to see Transformers 3, don't get me wrong, only because it looks ridiculous in terms of the level of effects. I mean, I'm sure it'll be pretty phenomenal work, I would imagine. But, you know, a movie like this probably has far fewer effects, and certainly not any effects that I think would be ones that we'll be talking about, you know, come next January or February when they're looking at the Academy Awards. Although, you know, maybe I could be wrong, but, you know, nothing super groundbreaking, but at the same time, I don't know. It's interesting to look at the difference between those two kinds of movies. Like, what is it that really gets people in the seats? Is it just pure, unadulterated, you know, no holds barred spectacle? You know, or is it really important in the long run to create a film that's going to have some staying power and that's going to last beyond, you know, the summer season?
Yeah.
And the post, you know, DVD season, to really have something where you have a character-driven piece where people are really going to care about the people and want to come back and revisit the thematic elements of the story.
It's a nicely balanced piece, really, in the end of the day, which I think is what does it.
Mm.
I mean, you've just asked yourself, would the film have been stronger if you'd seen what was going on outside in the petrol station? Or was it just, you know, completely brilliant to, at that stage in the film, have the guy with the Walkman on and have it out of focus kind of stuff happening and then have him walk out for the moment?
Again, seeing it from their point of view.
I mean, I just don't think...
Yeah, it's...
Yeah, you needed to see
that. It's the mystery box. That mystery box thing is... I mean, I think on that, in that respect, you know, J.J. Abrams, he's definitely hit on something, you know, maybe not totally of his own... invention, but I mean, he's really tapped into that in a way that it's true. I think it rings true in terms of what it is to go and sit in a cinema and watch a movie. What is it that makes us, you know, compels any and all of us to go sit and watch a film? And what is it that draws you into the story? Like, is it everything that you see that you couldn't see elsewhere, or is it what you are brought to imagine by what's presented to you on screen? And I think, you know, that's an interesting distinction that is really well played out in this film.
Yeah, it's what you leave out.
There's just one other thing I wanted to flag because I really enjoyed it. It was the, and it was, again, just one of those classic 70s type things. It was all the military guys running around with all their missiles firing incorrectly at each other and tanks just going everywhere. And it felt a bit like War of the Worlds, but it also felt kind of humorous and it was just like a kind of a fun sequence of, you know, burning cars and exploding houses. And it did give a lot of energy to that sequence. But, you know, it didn't lose its sense of humor either, because it was pretty silly with the kind of, you know, the tanks just sort of shooting each other and kind of upside down and, in 16 Ways from Sunday.
Well, and you know, that was the other thing I was going to ask you guys is, you know, in the story, and again, spoiler alert, I mean, although we've now crossed that line, but
I can see it
in the end
mirror.
Of the story, like what it all comes back to, right, is this whole thing where, you know, from a script point of view, it comes so tightly together where it's really about, you know, the creature literally is, you know, his grief of the loss of his mother, right? And, like, he winds up doing that thing at the end where he speaks to the creature and says, like, you know, bad things happen. Like, you can, you know, go on, you can go on, you can move on. And he's sort of yelling at the creature, telling the creature that the creature can go on. And he's sort of yelling these words that are the words that kind of he needs to hear for himself, right? Like, this, he's sort of, like, he becomes his own sort of transformational character in the story. And I was curious if you guys felt like the whole device of, you know, the necklace and all that stuff, it was that, I'll be honest, personally, like, I'm, you know, can be kind of schmaltzy about a movie like that, and it totally worked for me.
Yeah, but
I was wondering if you guys felt like that went too far. Like, was it too much? Was it too obvious?
I think that
it was just under the top in my book.
Yeah, I was actually asked that question because ironically, when I was talking to these guys at ILM, they hadn't seen the film.
Right.
Okay. It's like a little while, a few weeks ago.
Is it too schmaltzy?
They were saying, well, and I said, well, you know, if you go expecting this kind of a film, then the necklace and stuff, it all is good. But I'm sure if I was a 16-year-old boy and I was looking for some kick-ass, you know, there was not, wasn't like a lot of sex scenes in this film. There wasn't like gratuitous nudity. There was no, you know, it was really kind of that kind of film.
But
that
if you
the
were
Schmaltz
a 15 or 16 year old boy and you, if you were a 15 or 16 year old boy and you had a crush on a girl in your school, and or you'd lost one of your parents or something, you know, I mean, I just feel like it could still work.
So that's
I mean,
a relatively
like,
small demographic to appeal to.
In that respect.
We only want to appeal to 15-year-old boys who've lost their parents and who have crushes on
and
school.
Students. Yeah.
And who are film
no,
students.
No, but isn't it as cheesy as like E.T. though in that respect?
Right? Yeah, no, totally.
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying.
Spielberg is full of cheese. It's wonderful, A-grade, gorgeously fermented under
if you were going,
Swiss mountains cheese.
And you're
it's
good
wonderful.
With that, it was
that's
brilliant.
That's all I'm saying. They're the same devices.
Yeah. No, totally.
One of my favorite Spielberg films is very little loved by other people, which is Always, and it is full of cheese, and it is. But I just gets me emotionally
I
every
like
time.
Always.
It's fantastic. I love Always, and he's really, really good at that. I think it's fantastic. As I say, just under the top in my book.
All right, I think we've agreed in wrapping up. It's the greatest Spielberg film that Spielberg never made. And never directed, I should say, yes. Because he obviously was involved. And I honestly think that J.J. Abrams has done a really, really good job with this, but I also think the visual effects team have done a stellar job with this. I don't think we've had a single criticism of a visual effects shot from a point of view of a visual effects shot. No out-the-window shots that look like bad comps. No, the monster didn't feel like it was weighted. No, you know, I didn't feel like the articulation on the whatever or the... No, I mean, there's nothing. What?
No, I mean, for me, maybe the lighting of the train crash at the station, jumping way back to the beginning of the show, was maybe a little bit sort of diffused or ghostly or overly blue or something. It just felt a little bit. But at this point, you are, as we talked about when we covered that bit, we are so immersed in the impact of the event and the sound design and the whole drama of it and their reactions to it and the frenetic of it is that you are just, you know, completely... I didn't go out of the movie enough to worry about it, but my memory of it is probably that it just felt a little bit sort of ghostly, or I don't know, and just something in the lighting and or how it's all comped. But
I think it had tremendous production value, and I thought it was mint.
I also want to just say real quick before we finish up, the other visual effects supervisor from ILM was Russell Earle, who I just have to say, when I was working at ILM, I was a computer graphics resource assistant early on, helping allocate processors on Casper the Friendly Ghost, and Russell Earle was a graveyard shift assistant TD working in what in the parking lot in a trailer that was set up. And Russell Earle was one of the visual effects supervisors on this film. He also worked on Star Trek and Pirates of the Caribbean and stuff. And he's been at ILM for a long time. And Russell Earle is just one of the nicest
young guys that you'll ever meet in the business, and you know, just the phenomenal job by him, Kim LeBarry, and of course Dennis Muren too.
Well, Matt, you're going to be interested to know that we can't do it today because obviously it's not relevant. Next time we do a retro show, a retro ILM show, you'll be really glad to know that I got to spend a whole lot of time going over the optical printer at ILM and did interviews about it and understand it. And so next time we do a retro show, we're going to focus on the optical printer.
Fantastic. Because,
I had a great time up there with the guys. Okay, so in finishing up, Matt, where can people find you, follow you and stalk you?
Well, you can always check me out on my website, mattwallen.com. And just FYI, I will be, for the entire month of July, I will be in Iceland working on a project. And if you follow my exploits on either the Twitters or on my website, you'll see some probably hopefully exciting pictures of volcanoes and glaciers and whatnot.
Excellent. I'm jealous. It's on my life to-do list.
What an Iceland photographic exercise.
Yeah, Iceland in general. Yes, I think so.
Yeah, well, I'm about to go to France, Sweden and the UK, and the only thing I'm allowed to take is a camera because my wife wouldn't let me take a laptop, so I compromised. So then it was like, how am I going to
would that be an epic
no
camera?
Because I wouldn't be able to offload the
footage.
Wouldn't
be allowed in half the places.
No, exactly. So I had to buy a whole lot of 32 gig cards because I'm not allowed to offload my cards. And I've worked out I can take several thousand photos. I don't know how many photos you're taking, but I have a limit on how many thousand photos I can take based on the 5 32 gig cards that I've got. But at that point, I then have to start editing them in camera. There you go. Jason, what about you?
You can get me on twitter.com/Wingrove or jasonwingrove.com for my reel and all that stuff.
Well, thanks guys so much for being with us. I want to thank Todd Schultz, our producer, and Matt Graham, our other producer, for their brilliant stuff that they've done. Jason's waving his hands at me because he wants to mention that we'll be discussing some other stuff on another podcast.
Yes, so Mike and I, if you don't know, we also do a podcast called The RC, which is digital cinematography, filmmaking, digital imaging in general, gear.
Yeah, oh, I'm gear a fan porn, of that show. Holes. I didn't know you guys did that one.
Why did you just say Matt?
I'm just kidding.
Oh, okay.
I said I'm a huge fan of that show. I didn't realize that was
that
you
was
guys.
Us. I didn't realize it was that. Very funny.
I thought it
was.
Thanks, Matt.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. No.
Anyway, just to get another plug in there.
No. It's all good for the cross promotion. Obviously, looking at things from a different point of view. And a bunch of the stuff we've been talking about today will also appear, obviously, on FX Guide and in FX PhD next term, which term starts in, I'm going to say 2 weeks, beginning of July. And check that out over at fxphd.com when it comes. I want to thank the guys at ILM as well because, as I said, we were up there filming for about 3 days. We actually gave us the motion capture stage for several days. Went up to the ranch, up to Skywalker, and had a lovely lunch overlooking Ewok Lake and generally had an awesome time. We're actually up at Lucas talking to the Cars guys, Pixar guys, but we were down at ILM obviously talking about these films and stuff. So I really want to thank them. Terrific people at ILM, and I need to get part of my salary just automatically redirected to the ILM shop. So every time I come back, my kids have the most spectacular array of ILM crew T-shirts, which, of course, none of their friends appreciate. But maybe at some point they will. Great production value. Thanks so much for being with us, guys. See you.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2011 FX Guide, LLC.